Hi, and welcome back to the Shrapnel Podcast. I'm your host, Sam McElveen, and this is the second part of what was a two-hour live event with Imagine Belfast. Our guests were phenomenal. Our crowd, our audience was phenomenal. And you guys are phenomenal. Thank you for your support and help keeping this going. Enjoy the rest of the podcast.
I think to move on from it, and if we're going to talk about reconciliation, we need to be looking at the tools we need for that to deal with it. We can look at the big structures we need to put on at the top, but we need to look at a ground level. And I think Beano's trip into the arts as such shows young working class boys who have struggled through the troubles or who endured trauma, there's an outlet, and an acceptable outlet. It's not sissy, we'll call it sissy, to be involved in the arts. They're not going to be looked down upon. What he's actually doing is bringing a story to life for everybody else, you know.
Yeah.
That was a brave step on Beano's behalf to do that, from the background that he's from, to take that step forward and present that story. I mean, was it easy, Beano?
I've never seen it that way. To be honest, it was a gradual thing, and it's just something I always wanted to do, and it developed. It took a life of its own, really, and I was lucky enough, and very, very lucky, in that someone took an interest in it and helped me develop my stories, not just the drama, but with the poetry and the short stories and stuff like that. And it was just something that snowballed, really. I never seen it as, and I still don't, as something that is difficult. It's just something that I've learned how to do and enjoy doing it. And it's therapeutic, which is probably the main reason why I do it.
And that's where I'm angling you.
Do you know what I mean? It's an outlet, and I enjoy it.
And it's also what me and Gareth play into, is the history of the place, but done at our level, from our perspective, from our truths, our lived lives, our lived experiences. And that's where we struggle sometimes, is to get people to come forward and give their story. So when the likes of you do it, it opens doors.
No, well, I mean, I'm not the only one that does it. I'm probably, wouldn't be many from a loyalist perspective that writes the way I do and writes from that perspective. But you could maybe look at like a Gary Mitchell, who was a forerunner to me, and I enjoy a lot of Gary's work. You've David Ireland as well, who's maybe slightly different, but he comes from a working class background. He came from Sandy Row, and very, very successful. But I just see myself, I don't see myself as a loyalist writer as such. I probably write from a loyalist perspective, or I'm deemed that way. But some of the stuff I'm doing at the moment, it's not about loyalism, you know. The stuff I'm doing at the moment would be quite divorced from loyalism, really, you know. And the next thing, hopefully, that I get out there, but will have nothing to do with working class loyalism or unionism or whatever, you know. It's how I develop as well.
But it's your outlet. So even though the subject matter isn't loyalism, you'll always be the loyalist writer because you've come from that community, and that's not your choosing. I'm telling you now, that'll be foisted upon you.
No, I agree with you, you know, and if I'm being introduced, it's Beano Niblack, a loyalist.
Yeah,
you know, whether I want it or not, you know, and I have to accept that there's no way around. I hear, and it's done me well. Don't get me wrong, particularly a Davy Urban play, which went out last year, and it's going out again this September. I mean, it's probably made my mark.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm pleased with that there. But I'm equally as happy with the four plays I had out before that there. You know, and some of them. Well, someone played the big audiences and were well received. Some of them maybe went under the radar, but I'm as proud of them as I am with Davy Urban stuff, you know. So.
Okay. I think that's something that we need to develop too, as a subculture loyalism that it is. That when we talk about loyalist culture, everybody just points to the marching bands and they're going Jordan. But yeah. there are things going on in the background that involve
people from the Willis community. That's right. And to be honest, I was probably developmental in setting up the Legal Long Case Inside Out, the Alma Mater, which was its Facebook page, and other things that I would just be as proud of them as I would be of writing plays or writing poetry or writing short stories, in that it was giving people a voice that may not have been heard before. Now, the Legal Long Case Inside Out has maybe fell by the wayside, although it's being revitalized. But I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of giving people a voice to state their loyalism.
You know, I'd like to come in there and want to give you an opportunity to do a couple of the poems. But I think there's an issue here. You talk about doing the plays and the poetry, and there hasn't been many people who have come in behind you from that background to do the same thing. And I think there's two strands here. There's Emma, because we don't hear enough women from the loyalist community, and we don't hear enough from the ex-prisoner community.
I've had this conversation with you on many occasions, and you know my feelings on it. I have tried to, I've already said, our Long Case Inside Out, the Alma Mater, a couple of other things I sat up, the writers group, which didn't happen, but there's people don't want to put their heads above a parapet.
Yeah.
I understand that. You know as well as I do, because you know the people I'm talking about, that there's some guys out there, and girls, by the way, who are very, very talented in writing, but for their own reasons, they say, I don't really want my name in the papers or anything. I don't want to be like you, and I don't want to have my name in lights. And I understand that.
Yeah. And that's a frustration we've encountered, because we've done the events in Portadown, Shankill, East Belfast. Mm-hmm. And after every single one of them, when you did the poetry and the bit from the play with John Travers, I did a wee bit about the research. Mm-hmm. People always come up and say, we're never, it's like the us and them that we'll go back to. Nobody ever tells our story. We're never heard. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, do you want to tell your story? And people say, then it's like, it's very rinky thing. People think there's the motivation on the night. Mm-hmm. And then it just like falls by the wayside.
I get stuff sent to me all the time by email, by private messages, by WhatsApp, whatever. What do you think of this? I says, get it out there.
Yeah.
No, don't want my name to it. And it's so frustrating, because these people are talented. You know them. You know who I'm talking about.
I know exactly. You can visualize them.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's the same as a Long Case Inside Out. You still go on Long Case Inside Out. Yeah. You'll see some fantastic pieces of writing with an alias.
And what had it in the Shankill and the Spectrum Centre 5.5 years ago? Particularly, I think it was one of the events we did, there was a women's group there. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the women's experience and loyalism and how important it was to get it out there. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, it isn't able to come out. Emma, can you talk to that? Why is it held back?
I don't know if held back is the right word to use. I think, like what Beano's touched on a little bit about putting your head above that parapet. Myself, I could probably name you 5 loyalist females that speak out. Yeah, and that would be it. And every single one of us has got absolute backlash on Twitter, social media, stalked. Negative connotations. Yeah. And in a society where women are already at risk, where there is increased domestic violence, where there is increased violence against women, where women's rights are continuously violated, women normally, and I understand why, have to consider their own safety whenever they're doing these things. And so I understand that. I would love more loyalist women to speak out. And actually at Phoenix Education Centre, we did put out a, post asking for females, young women to come forward, because we want to put you through some media training so that you can do more of that, because young people were saying, we'd do that, but we don't have the confidence, right? We've had one young person come to us, and that's not, I know there's probably girls out there that want to do it, but it's all of those negative, and I'm not saying that, you know, there's not social media against men either, but whenever it's a female, it doesn't just go about your looks, your appearance, what you're wearing, things that they want to do. It just takes on a whole separate thing. And they come after your family. And so I understand why there's not. So, and I've been asked this question when Bino had me speaking on the panel. There was a guy in the audience that asked, how do we encourage more females to speak out? And I would say this to the men in the room and listening to this, make it a safe space for women to speak out.
Yeah.
Make women feel that their opinions are valid, that they are supported, that they're not a threat or that they're not at risk when they do that, because only by creating a safe space for women to speak out will we enable more women to actually speak out. So I don't think it's that we're being held back. I think it's how society treats women at the moment, and that's the reality.
I mean, that's absolutely the case. I mean, I've seen it myself on social media. And, you know, there's a bit of an elephant in the room here that we're all sort of avoiding. And that is that, you know, it's not terribly safe for anyone to be putting their head above the parapet. Mm-hmm. And that feeds into particularly what Emma's saying, and women get it far worse. But also for these guys who would write stuff, and women, you know, who also said, no, I wouldn't want my name in lights, I don't want my name in the paper. What they're actually saying is, I'm afraid of the feedback.
Well, I'll
because, sure. And they're not going to write, you know yourself, anybody who writes knows that it's very hard to write what you don't believe. So you tend to write what you actually believe and what you actually think.
Well, I'm going to share.
And that's where the danger is.
So the blog, Her Loyal Voice, was, and it's not me that runs it. I have contributed to it in the past.
I was involved in doing some of the interviews.
So
I'm happy to say that. Yeah.
So the interviews, we conducted about 65, 70 interviews of women, and 12 of them agreed to do their, no, slightly more than that, agreed to do their stories, whittled it down to a publication for 12. Of those 12, only 6 agreed to put their name to it publicly, and 6 were pseudonyms. And of those 12, whenever I went onto the media and done the, we did like a release, and I went on and spoke about, the presenter at the time singled one woman's story out, and it was because she shared her experience of her husband being in the UDA and how she ended up then joining and activities that she took part in. And this reporter singled out her and basically said that us, as in the platform, were then encouraging and supporting paramilitary involvement. Yeah. But for the women who were sharing their stories, it was therapeutic, and it was, that's why we encouraged them to write their own stories, and we didn't write their stories for them, we encouraged them. Mm-hmm. And so it is that perception about how things are received by not just the community, but by politicians, reporters, other writers. It's all of those things.
I mean, David called it feedback. Sometimes it's not feedback.
Sometimes it's not feedback. It's just,
no.
We'll not say what it is.
As somebody who, believe me, experienced the real feedback, you know, and that was, I needn't say it was one of the reasons, but, I mean, every time for...
Physical feedback?
Yeah. Every time, for example, that I would agree to do the podcast with yourselves, my wife and my youngsters, who are now middle age or close to middle age, are very, very nervous about it. My daughter would still be triggered by certain things. Now, this is 20 years later. Yeah. So when I retired, I had no desire to start commenting and all the rest of it anyway, but I decided for the reasons that I've mentioned earlier, but I'm very careful about what I say and what I write and what I comment on, simply because there's a fear in me, but also my family have never done anything on anyone, and they suffered far more than I did. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. But I was going to say about, just on a broader point, about young people from a loyalist community. I mean, to encourage, what we really need to be thinking of as well is encouraging a sense of self-worth. And that is identifying skills, whatever those skills may be, and encouraging them and helping them to, you know, not exploit them, but develop them and all the rest of it.
So we do actually, so the group of young boys that I work with, we do talk about community development, growth mindset. We talk about, you know, all of these other things as well. But when they're still negatively being put down by teachers, the other elephant in the room, unfortunately, not all teachers are supportive of young people's education. But, you know, and other adults, it does start to be that perception that they can have all of the self-worth, but then when they have society telling them, no, you're a knuckle dragger, or you're just a bonfire builder, or that fill in the blanks, then it's really hard for a young person. And then they also have social media to deal with. When I was growing up, we didn't have social media, you know, it was barely the internet. But I've now got 3-second videos. Everybody can see if there's a fight somewhere, it's shared, it goes into a group chat. So teenagers live a very different life now with different pressures as well. And so it's not that they don't necessarily want to speak out or they're not encouraged to speak out. We are doing work on that at a community level. It's just, you know, you've got all of these other competing challenges. They've got to go to school. They've got to get their exams to get a good job. And, you know, they're only in school 13% of their time, as Jackie likes to say. And so.
From my point of view, then, I'm talking in general. You work a lot within loyalism and particularly with women. Mm-hmm. But is your general perception that there's a lack of self-motivation or self-confidence within loyalism in general?
I would go back to that class issue, and I would say working class people have multiple other pressures that they're dealing with, especially women. You're running a house, you're looking after your kids, you're maybe trying to work. You don't have time to better yourself.
But you think that, and this is my own opinion, in this past 10 years, probably from a flag protest, I think there's this, I sense a thing within loyalism that poor us.
In some cases, I think it is some people that play into
that. You keep telling us that we're impoverished, that we're undereducated, and the war, this is a cloak.
Yeah.
Am I right?
I do think sometimes. Not so much younger people I find that with older people that are more entrenched, that are more like, yes, like, well, you took this from us or da da da, whatever. But I think with younger people, they have a much brighter vision until they get to a certain point and we just keep hammering them. But I do think that would be more with the older generation that I would say. But I do think... Yeah. There's lots to be done.
A general impression I have in this last load of years, people say, well, sure, you keep telling us we're not worth it.
Yeah.
The other thing I see, having come through the political party, I find a lot of people coming forward, male and female, wanting to make a difference, and they take a charge at it and they start and they get 3-4 months into it and the constant battering. And again, the ladies that I've worked with in the parties get it worse because it is, what are they wearing? What do they look like? The comments, pig with lipstick. You don't get that of the male reps, but they get hammered as well. And they're young and not overly confident about the ground that they're walking. They give up because they're sick of it and they go back because, as you said, they've got the other pressures. They're trying to hold down a job if they're lucky to have one. Mm. They're trying to keep a family together in a house and heating.
Yeah.
What they don't need is this other crap that comes with sticking their head up. So, We bring these people forward, we get them enthused, and we throw them in there.
And then they get
hammered and they're burnt out. And then we're wondering why we don't have the next generation of Davy Irvines and Davy Adams, Billy Hutchinson, Gareth Michaels coming through, because we've destroyed them.
There's a load of great people that want to do the work, but they can't be paid for it, and we can't ask people to do peace and reconciliation work for free. Like, I think we seen during COVID who were actually out delivering the food parcels. It was working class communities on the ground. It wasn't the politicians in their nice fancy houses. They were having parties and everything else, but it was working class communities that knew who were at risk, who were out delivering food parcels and everything else. And I think that when we look at peace and reconciliation and moving this place forward, it needs to be at that grassroots community level, but people need to be paid for their work because they can't sustain themselves through just by motivation.
Whenever I talk about reconciliation, I'm not necessarily talking, or even to any great extent, talking about organizations and all the rest of it. I'm talking about attitudes. Now, I mean, we need to start viewing whoever the other side is as human beings, equal to ourselves, no real threat, not keep comparing what we have got with what they have got and all this. I mean, it's not about, to my mind, you know, it's attitudes. It's an attitudinal thing that has been hammered at for decades, hammered into us, whether it be at home, the area we live in, which is almost usually in working class areas, it's either one side or the other. Almost, you know, totally. You know, people, as I keep saying, people aren't meeting anyone from the other side knowingly until their attitudes have been developed. It's about...
A lot of us down to acceptance. And the thing, you know, go back 20-odd years ago, I got out of prison in 1990.
That wasn't 20 years ago.
Sad to say. 20 years ago.
I was never good at maths.
Sadly. I wish it was.
And then I went to work for Epic and done a lot of work with ex-Republican prisoner groups like Atara, Taranal, Tarawalia, Koisha, groups like that there. Never thought I would ever do that type of work. But I became friendly with people, and I still am, you know. And, you know, I do a lot of work with, like, Lawrence McKeown, Ricky O'Raw, Danny Morrison. You know, if you told me 20 years ago I'd be associating with those people, I'd laughed. But I do.
Yeah.
You know, and I accept them for what they are. They're no threat to me.
We know at an abstract level. Everybody knows at an abstract level. Probably that the other side, people from the other side are no different. But at their everyday level, it's an us and them ones. And, you know, the us and them are the poor, the working class, the neglected, the impoverished, call it what you will, and those who aren't. And those who are feeding off that politically and businesses and all the rest of it. I mean, I
would just add, but when you talk about, you know, safety and threat and stuff like that, we have to, you know, we'll address the elephant in the room. There still are instances of violence at interface areas, especially at particular times of the year. And so I have spoke to women who are on women's groups, and they still don't feel safe. So, and they tend to be older women. So whether that's real or perceived, in some cases, some people prefer to stay in their own community because that's where they feel safe. And those are people who have lived through the trauma of the Troubles. And so we need to also, while, yes, 100% work towards peace and reconciliation, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, we have to also address that we have so much trauma that lives within everybody on this island, especially in Northern Ireland, and because we're a post-conflict society. And we have never dealt with that trauma. We're, mental health is not adequately funded. We don't, our waiting lists for young people and older people in general are absolutely atrocious. There's young people are waiting for diagnoses for like 12, 18 months before they can get any sort of support. There is so much research done by academics at York, Ulster University, where trauma is actually handed down from parent to child. Mm-hmm. So unless we actually disrupt that cycle.
But these are all issues we have in common.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah.
And should be working together on.
Yeah. And politicians hold the purse strings to address some of those strategies.
But they also play in that division.
Because
every
they
time.
Need to get voted in.
Not just
because they need to get
not
voted
just
in.
At election time.
Yeah.
But particularly in election time. Yeah.
But
and we fall for it every time.
But I think
and we're
this
back
is
to the
where,
useful patsies again. We're going in a circus, yeah. And here we are.
But that is
you
where
know.
We can work better as an alliance of people. Don't misrepresent that as alliance, the political party. But I think we need to work better as an alliance of people to make our politicians and hold our political representatives to account, regardless of party, regardless of, you know, political persuasion. We need to hold them accountable for poverty strategies, mental health strategies, women's safety strategies, all of those other things, because they're the ones that pull those political levers.
Yeah, because adverse childhood experiences don't stop at a peace wall.
Nope.
Don't stop at a border.
Nope. And they don't stop at a specific moment in time. Just because we signed the Good Friday Agreement, you know, doesn't mean, oh, we live in peaceful times now. That's job done. That's
absolutely.
Just move on.
That's the way it was treated.
Yeah.
But
that's the way the major political parties treated it.
But we also know that in the UK.
The banked, the ceasefires, the decommissioning, and Stormont, and ignored the very essence of the Good Friday Agreement, which is reconciliation.
But here's
and
why.
As well as that, I mean, we expect politicians to lead and set examples. But we have to make an effort ourselves as ordinary people. That's what I'm saying. There's nobody in Northern Ireland who can't, if they aren't already doing it, make some sort of effort. Should it only be in their own attitude, what to say, what to write, you know.
Well, there's a wee saying, and I have it on a T-shirt, so if anybody wants to buy it, they can buy it. But it says...
Plug the shop.
So we sell clothing, yes, as because we're a social enterprise, Phoenix Education Centre, because, you know, we don't want to rely on government grants and funding. But so one of the T-shirts actually says, one person can't do everything, but everyone can do something.
Yeah.
And I think that really touches with what you're saying.
Yeah.
But
and
my point that I wanted to just say was, in terms of UK government, when they look at reconciliation, they're very good at saying, Northern Ireland gets more than its fair share. We are something like £9,000 per head per capita more than the rest of the UK, et cetera, et cetera. Our civil service is inadequately funded, but also it doesn't take into consideration the mental health, the trauma that was experienced, and also addressing segregated housing, addressing segregated education. We have not had the investment to actually allow our politicians and community members to adequately address those issues.
And that's, you know... Just as on one point, you know, let's not confuse peace with reconciliation or imagine that reconciliation automatically follows peace. Mm. It doesn't. It's peace is essential to reconciliation, obviously, but it has to be worked at.
But do we have peace or do we just have a status?
A cessation of violence.
Yeah,
we've got to pause.
Peace is the canvas and reconciliation is the graft.
Yeah.
That we'll have to keep working at.
That's the prize.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if we don't work at it as individuals in all sorts of ways, you know, I mean, the history of Ireland, if anybody thinks that a period of peace, that reconciliation will gradually and naturally and somehow by magic will develop out of that, then they may be right. But I don't think they are because... The history of Ireland proves...
We have the ability to hold grudges for centuries.
Oh.
And pass them down through
that's
generations.
Only the imagined grudges, you know?
On that bombshell, I think we'll bring the discussion to a close.
Well, I'll say one more thing before we wrap up.
I want to give Beano a chance to...
I'm aware there are people in the room who are here to understand loyalism a bit better and maybe want to have a conversation. And what I would say, on the back of what we're saying about young people and people who are novices to us coming forward... It's on you guys to create the safe space for them to talk. You may not like what you're hearing from them, but unless you create that safe space for them to talk, you're never going to understand this. You've got to have respect. You've got to have patience. You've got to listen to what we're actually saying. I don't mean just give it 10 minutes of hearing time and walk away. You've actually got to listen to what we're saying. So those young people that are coming through, when you see people shutting them down and giving them abuse online, weigh in. Give them your support and encourage them to keep going, because that's where you're going to hear the authentic voice of loyalism and the loyalism that we need to hear today. And I think before we close up, we'll get Beano to maybe finish him a poem or two, just to give us a bit of culture to finish.
You want that.
Of course you want to.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, we'll see.
Go for it, Beano.
What's that?
That's go Davey, for it. It's not me.
Go for it. Let me see.
We will open up after this for questions. If anybody's got anything on their mind they want to ask, please.
We the people in that book.
What's that?
We the people.
We the people.
We the people. Is it in there?
No.
No.
No. It's not. Not that picture. No.
I don't think so.
No.
Which one's that in, Christopher?
I'm going. I'll read a wee.
It should be. Yeah, it's Trouble's Curriculum, isn't it?
And this one?
No, that one.
That one. The one you have. It's a list on the back.
Yeah, cool. On the back.
The
contents in the back.
We have maybe been worked out for the last time.
Now, what I'll do is, I'm going to read a wee poem here. It's from 1971, and it's probably, I was 16. I turned 16 in 1971, and it was probably the last year of freedom, I suppose, because I was part of the phenomenon. It was the tartan gangs at the time, who were quite a sectarian outfit, who became, by the next year, I became a young paramilitary as a 17-year-old. So in many years, or in many ways, it was the last year that, although I was only 16 and wasn't a paramilitary, and the poem's called, it's set in 1971, the poem's called That Last Summer. Less than a year since my leaving certs, and a month from D-Day, when pennies turned to nupes, I careered into 16. Tank tops and DMs, the apparel of choice. Cordite leaden air became a norm, and booms and cracks that we quickly learned to identify. Normality was slowly sneaking out the side door. Midget gang rumbles on summer nights and one-night stands. Normal was Charlie George, Lance of Pain on the Wembley turf, or us getting it on with rival clans. August was a salvo that blew in like an unwelcome guest and refused to leave. Early summer cool, replaced with a dread and fear that wormed into our being. An edge that stuck and stayed for a long time. Too early to be defining, but as that carefree season turned dark, and the 100 marks are passed, in an ultra shift, I sense the caress of fate. Autumn seen as duped, won't get fooled again, would never sound more ironic, in an iconic year, a year to remember, never to forget. Another one.
I'm sure we'll go to the interrogation.
It's Beano's books are available to buy, but they're raw for a lot of us. And I don't care what side of the sort of fence you think you come from. When you read this stuff, it will take you back in a way that is real. We've plugged them a shop. We'll plug it, Beano's books, and Davey doesn't need any plugging really, other than the mouth, maybe to shut him up for a while.
You know us, wee man.
Yeah, I know.
Start around an empty house.
I know. So we're going to open up the questions. So if anybody's got anything, please ask the panelists, not me and Gareth, because we always do the talking. So if you have any questions, stick up your hand. There is a mic going about.
Hi there. This has been a really fascinating panel tonight, so thanks very much for putting it together. One thing that does interest me is, and it's, you know, hinted in some of the conversations, is because of the class element. And I'm also wondering as well, because nationalism, sort of post Good Friday Agreement, kind of went in a more, dare I say, Eurocentric direction, because it acts as a decent facsimile of United Ireland, where, you know, the border's gone, everything's very European, very posh. Whereas, to my sort of perspective, loyalism didn't really react to it. So then, what happens is in 2012, when you've got the flag protest, which almost kind of acted like as a precursor to the Brexit and Trump sort of years in 2016, where you had this sort of mass sort of pop sort of uprising of a population that was sort of by and large misunderstood. And even though to this day, you know, you still speak to people about the flag protest, and people just, you know, will say flag shag or whatever, but some of those are the same people who, you know, would drape themselves in various flags of, you know, whatever conflict's going on at the moment. So what I'm wondering is, I've seen over the years, there's been attempts by certain populist elements to sort of tap into that within loyalism. Like you had, I think, for Britain, you had Britain First, and they all seem to sort of die a death. So is there really a chance that loyalism could sort of maybe tap into that populism that is sort of happening around Europe and certainly in the South at the moment and become almost like a different entity?
Do you mean politically?
Politically, socially, culturally?
I think that we have enough political parties in Northern Ireland, but I don't think any of them adequately represent loyalism. So if there was somebody who had the money and resources to have a party that worked for the working class people, and people went out and voted for them, then yes, then you could tap into that. But we have such voter apathy in loyalism that it would have to, I would say it would probably be a lot of like personality, like a lot, like a huge personality like Trump. But who has that sort of money? I don't mean like Trump. I don't mean like to be Trump. I just mean like somebody who has that charisma and, you know, can really bring the populace together. And I don't know that we have somebody that can do that.
Simple answer to your question is, I don't know. But I sincerely hope not. I mean, populism is a poison in the world at the moment, threatening to destroy democracy. We saw it first with Trump, and it's looking to my mind, or maybe I'm just scared, you know, but it's looking to my mind as if it's quite a likelihood that he'd be elected again. But we don't even have to look any as far as America now to see populism and where it leads. We've only to look across the water, I think. So I really, if I was a believer, what I would be saying is, I pray to God that populism doesn't come here. It's a tiny, there's a tiny showing of, very loud showing of it in the South, but tiny nonetheless. Let's hope that's what, you know, that it stays that size. It's the last thing any of us need.
Could be a bad mixture.
Hmm?
Bad mixture.
You didn't really mention tonight current loyalist paramilitary groups, because it seems to me the people they hurt the most is loyalist communities themselves. So you've got the obvious issues, selling drugs. Then you've got, you know, protection rackets. So it's hard for like a business set up, like a working class Protestant area, we're getting a knock on the door looking for money. Then as Emma mentioned earlier on, about money is being sent into these areas, and a lot of it gets funneled off into these kind of proxy groups and these guys driving around with Range Rovers. So what do you do about that elephant in the room? How do we, 25 years later, why have we still got these guys who the deputy chief constable, I think, described as criminal gangs wrapped up in a flag?
Well, I could jump in there first and say not all loyalist paramilitaries are drug dealers, and not all drug dealers are within the loyalist community. There's plenty of them knocking about the country. We've seen that from the gun attacks, people being shot in their streets in Belfast. They didn't happen in loyalist areas. So it's not a loyalist problem. That is a cultural, societal problem, drugs. And drugs need to be taken off the street, full stop. I don't care where they come from. They need to be removed from our society. That's the first thing. As for funding, I think Emma was hinting at the fact it's not going into the pockets of the paramilitaries. That's not what she was saying.
No.
It's going into the pockets of these large groups, national groups, that come in to these areas to tell us what we need.
Your charities in many cases, yeah, and try to say what it is that we need. And like what you said, you know, the elephant in the room, yes, there are still paramilitaries, mm-hmm. right? But we're not here to address that as a panel. We are here to talk about loyalists, and not all loyalists are paramilitaries, and not all paramilitaries are loyalism. So, or loyalists, sorry.
I think it's already been pointed out that it's a societal thing.
Yeah.
It's not just loyalism who are entrenched in drugs or racketeering. It happens across the board.
Mm-hmm. It happens across the world.
Some high loyalism gets a brunt of it. You know, yeah. And here, listen, don't get me wrong. If loyalists are involved in it, it's wrong and it shouldn't be happening. But it's not just loyalists who are involved in this. It's a societal thing. Right across the board. Not just in Belfast, throughout Northern Ireland and throughout Ireland.
And if we believe what the papers are printing,
no,
whether you can believe that or not, the drugs aren't being shipped in by loyalists. They're being given to them by
Republicans
in the South.
They work together, cross-community basis.
So this sort of level of criminality doesn't recognise the normal boundaries that we recognise. If they're making money off the pain and suffering of a community, they don't care what community they're making it from it and who's selling the drugs for them. They'll continue to keep bringing them in and pushing what they're pushing. So, and if you're asking, do loyalist paramilitaries need to be around at this time? I would say not. I would ask them to leave the stage, and I'll be the first to do that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a paramilitary. I don't have that authority to tell them to go. I can only tell them my wish.
I'm sorry to be perfectly honest about it. That's part and parcel of sticking the head above the parapet mm-hmm. that you're talking about in terms of ourselves. And I, for one, I'm not prepared to do that at the moment. But I take your points.
But you would also, I genuinely
take all your points. And, of course, drugs aren't just associated with loyalist communities and all the rest of it. But yeah.
But we also have to work with people where they're at to bring them on a journey.
Yeah.
So you can't just say, okay, you're a paramilitary, we are not going to work with you. We're trying to transition people into a peaceful society, and that means working with them and getting down into the community level and working with people, and that's what a lot of organisations already do. But it's not easy. It's not well funded. It's work that goes on behind the scenes because you can't advertise it because, again, it's the safety element. So there is already work that goes on, but, yeah, it is.
Sam, what I would say to people here is, if anyone's got a question for Davey, a burning question for him, ask it now because his taxi's outside. He wanted to make a quick getaway. So.
No, my son brought me down and I originally thought it was an hour thing. So he's outside waiting on me, and he's ringing there.
It's your fault.
Any excuse to get off the stage?
No, seriously, he is.
Enjoy tonight very much. Thank you, H. Davey, yeah. Obviously your politics, I would share a lot of your politics, even though I come from the other side of the town and the other side of the politics, but I only hear what loyalists say. Yeah. It's important to me. So we're being when I met before, that the question to you is, of course, you talk very much class politics.
Yeah.
You understand, as myself, and I see that as being the common denominator that we need to be aiming for.
Yeah.
We had it here in the 30s when Catholic and Protestant unionized and marched on the state, violently pushed it because it seemed the danger.
Of course.
The people who the powerful people, it doesn't matter, it's a class thing, where they wanted to rule us. We had to be their puppets. We were the labour that they got rich on.
Yeah.
But we need, certainly, to try to develop more and more within a community's class politics.
Of course.
Yeah, commonality.
Of course. I'm pointing out the commonalities. I mean, the multitude of commonalities in comparison to what separates and divides is, I mean, the divisions are, or should be, infinitesimal.
Yeah.
Infinitesimal. But those divisions are exploited, played upon, excited, exaggerated for political gain and have been for years.
Yeah.
And as I keep saying, we keep falling for it and we have to stop falling for it. I mean, I've said at the start, I grew up in a very small estate, 38 houses, and in a row of four houses, and we were the only Protestants in the row. But there was this loaf of bread, right? You remember when you used to make, your mum used to make lunches every night and all the rest for going out to work. There was this loaf of bread used to pass between us, our next door neighbour, and another neighbour who lived. Nobody knew who, nobody owned this loaf of bread. It moved about that often. But that was a community, commonality. You know, we haven't missed Bradley, see if she's a loaf for it. Having a loaf, we'll give you half it. You can tell your mum we'll give her half. The next night, somebody maybe from the other house would come, oh, your mummy has chani bread. Oh, aye, there's half a loaf. You know, that's the sort of thing.
Can't eat a flag.
Well, you could chew on it, you're not swallowing too much of it. Listen, the sun's waiting outside for me. Thanks very much. Good to meet you all, and
I wish I could say the same, Davey. Yeah.
It's always a pleasure.
You may go.
I'm a wee bollocks, but I'm not that bad.
Jesus Christ.
You're right.
Next question.
Thank you. So I am from a working class loyalist background and absolutely unashamed of it. I'm also a trade unionist, and that's how, because there's a lack of working class loyalist people being able to achieve what they need to through political parties and whatever, a lot of us try and use our trade unionism as our way to do that. And the left is the centre, in my opinion, of which Republican and loyalism can work with each other. But there's a debate there about the resources, and my own personal belief is neoliberalism will never provide us the vehicle to transition through prosperity, which will be the vehicle that it ends up with reconciliation. While we've all to compete against each other, community against community, and I absolutely dot my hat to Republican communities and how well they're organised in securing that funding, and loyalist communities have a lot to learn. So while we continue with neoliberalism, which does not provide enough and we've all to compete for it, we will remain in competition with each other instead of reconciling with each other. And where there's division, that is what will be thrived upon to maintain the sectarianism.
Thank you. Look at what's happened here in West Belfast, where the Falls Women's Centre and the Shankill's Women's Centre have come together have had a long experience of working together in solidarity with each other. That's a model we should follow.
We spoke to Elise Rooney about this.
It's actually quite common, you know, and it's not highlighted enough. You know, and as the guy's saying there, we need to get away from this notion of us and them.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and the example you're giving is the way forward. But it does happen on quite a regular basis. I know from the work that I do, or I don't really work, to be honest. I'm retired, but you know what I'm talking about. But the thing is, yes, that does. It happens a lot. And there's a lot of cross-community stuff that's not highlighted.
There is a lot of that.
For whatever reason. Yeah. But it's just that we need to somehow get away from the us and them situation.
But But even in the world of cross-community and community development work, we are all still in competition with each other for funding. So when we're applying for grants or we're applying for tenders or whatever it happens to be, you cannot strategically plan in your organization with year-on-year funding. And that is a big issue. And that's why, you know, we've tried to combat that by being a social enterprise, but it is part of the model of the UK and the charity sector and the voluntary sector is that you're competing for funding. So I think there is more space for businesses to come on board to actually, so people in the room might be familiar with the social value clauses within public tender contracts. That is a key element where businesses can be working with charities and nonprofits to make an impact in the community. It's about how we actually make sure that that goes to where it's most needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go call on this.
Hi, I'm from East Belfast, traditionally like a quite staunch unionist family. And at the minute, like I have to say, I feel quite disenfranchised. Like I have heard nothing but common sense. I think this is brilliant tonight. But where are these voices in mainstream politics?
Sitting here.
Like I go, yeah, but I go to the ballot box and it's like, this is shite.
You're in good company with us.
Yeah, like I mean, why is there, like where is... Like, how do we reclaim unionism and loyalism when we have the DUP and so many empty vessels making an awful lot of noise? It's very frustrating. Very frustrating.
I agree with you. I mean, totally. We have lost any voice that we had when we lost the UDP and the PUP. I mean, you lost that sort of...
It was exciting.
It was an authentic loyalist voice. And they talked common sense. And they talked the language we understood. They talked the language that everybody wanted to hear.
But many of us don't want to go into politics because we're not going to actually be able to do the work that we want to do. You know, you're going to have to toe a party line, whatever the party leadership decide that you're going to do. You're very much like, really, what can I achieve within a political party? Or can I achieve more by...
Do you think there's a way out of the future, or just kind of stop with...
I think we need to do a better job, and in East Belfast particularly, we do have that voter apathy. We need more people to get out to the ballot box to put the pressure on the political parties, because the political parties need to work for us and not the other way around.
Or not, but...
I told you.
Yeah.
Does it work?
Yeah, it works.
It works. Really very much enjoyed being here this evening, listening, and was delighted to be invited to participate in the Shrapnel podcast, which I recommend to everybody in the audience and listening. It's a wonderful initiative.
Your fiver's in the post, Colin.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose the question I have relates to the title of the event tonight, which is Loyalism, Alternative Voices. And it's the first word in that, because you've rightly emphasized the pluralism and diversity and pushing back against sort of monolithic caricatures and stereotypes that many people try to push back against in this complex society. But the question really is to everyone on the stage is, what does loyalism, it's a definitional question, right? Because I heard earlier people say, well, I'm not a royalist. So in 2024, to everyone on the stage, What does loyalism mean to you in 2024? What is, because you've all articulated different visions and approaches, and what is it in an increasingly pluralist society, these islands and all of that, what is the loyalism to? What is the vision? What is loyalism? The first word in the title for tonight. I just want to thank you all for your contributions as well.
Well, what it means to me, I'll just kick it off.
From a personal point of view, I don't know if it answers your question or not, but from a personal point of view, loyalism to me, I'm 69, has evolved greatly over the years. And probably the best way of describing it to you would be that what I thought I was loyal to in the 1970s, which maybe become a young paramilitary, I'm not so sure I would be loyal to the same thing now. You know, I firmly believed then that I came from an interface area and I experienced Republican violence every day of the week. That's what made me do what I did. Not an excuse by any stretch of imagination, but that's what I thought I had to do as a 16-year-old. But I'm not, I was loyal, as I thought then, to the UK, to Britain. Britain doesn't care about me now.
I don't think Britain cares about anybody.
So I'm not so sure I'm still loyal to that same cause. You know, I'm loyal to my community.
Yeah, I think that's the
word. You know, and that's the essence of it.
It's community. It's that working class ethic, that sort of ethnic background to it. And maybe people will pull on the royal family or pull on our militaristic history or the UK or whatever. But it all comes back to that sense of belonging in a community and facing the everyday oppression and challenges that it has. I think that's what I'm loyal to. I'm loyal to that community. I mean, I'm not a royalist by any stretch of the imagination. And the UK governments come and go, but it's my community.
That's the difference to me, you know, and that's probably.
I don't think there is any one. Like, there isn't just one definition for anything, realistically. And so, loyalism, like everybody's personal identity, is something that's personal to them. And it's something that only that person can define for themselves. And that may evolve over time. But I think when you look at loyalist cultural identity, it does evolve as well. And it does have its own elements that are unique to perhaps other cultures.
And how are you a loyalist, Gareth?
Well, coming from the outside.
We've just adopted them.
Yeah.
For me, loyalism's a financially unwise choice of career research. It hasn't got me any, it hasn't made me any money, unfortunately. There's maybe plenty of friends. That's the main thing.
Are they friends?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'd like to think so. Exactly. I had a full head of hair when I started, yeah.
Well, everyone, thank you very much. Myself and Gareth, I don't know whether Bino and Emma will be hanging about. We'll be hanging about for 5-10 more minutes if you want to come and have a chat or any other questions that we can't do on stage. But we want to thank the Arts Centre. We want to thank Imagine Belfast for having us, and especially our guests. I know Davey's not here, thankfully. But Emma is, and Bino is. And the guys who have helped in the background with the sound and everything else, and Sarah. Thank you for coming along and continue to listen.
Hi guys, it's me, Sam McElwain again. I just like to say again, thank you for myself and Gareth. That was a fantastic event. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. I know the guys in the room did. And again, just big thanks out to Peter O'Neill and Alan Maben from Imagine for all their help in the build up to this, and Sarah Harrison again for help on the night. Invaluable. And the biggest thanks is, of course, to everybody who turned up, bought a ticket, sat in a seat, interacted with us, and for all you guys listening out there. We hope to announce some more live events soon, so keep an eye on us. Thank you.